About 75 years ago, Thomas Henry Huxley, the man who has been called the statesman of 19th century science, wrote something in one of his many essays which is probably more meaningful today than at the time it was written. He said,
"Logical consequences are the scarecrows of fools and the beacons of wise men."
Supporting evidence from the present follows immediately.
United Nations Radio presents Beacons of Wisdom, a report in recognition of the spirit and practice of international cooperation in science. This program introduces the voices of a number of distinguished men of science from a number of different countries. They were recorded by UN Radio in personal interviews and during recent international conferences. Their statements are among the brightest of today's Beacons of Wisdom.
It's hardly necessary to labour the point in woeful words, the point that has been made so many times in so many contexts, that the fruits of modern science in general, and of nuclear physics in particular, can be either bitter or sweet, according to the way we harvest them. But before coming to the substance of this programme, it might be helpful to recall briefly where we all stand at this particular moment in history, and something of the essential nature of science. In September this year, at the second United Nations Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy, the conference president, Professor Francis Perrin of France, had some relevant things to say in his opening address to the 6,000 delegates from 69 nations. There was this, for example.
Pour le meilleur et pour le pire, elle a uni sa destinée à celle de la science, à nous tous.
For better or worse, man has linked his destiny to that of science. It is up to us to do everything we can to avert the worst and to exalt the best. Those glorious conquests of the spirit, the dignity of man facing his destiny, trying to understand and to master it.
And as a logical consequence of that, this.
On dit souvent que la science n'est en elle-même ni morale ni immorale, que ce n'est que dans l'usage fait de ses applications.
It is often said that science in itself is neither moral nor immoral, that good or evil can only appear in the uses to which it is put, and that scientists have no reason to differ morally from other men. All this is largely true. We must not, however, disregard the influence in character formation of the practice of the disciplines of scientific research and of teaching the sciences. Science actually requires a perfect sincerity with oneself, as well as with others, an objective pursuit of truth which goes beyond its own field and penetrates the nexus of relationships between men. It demands a discipline of thought and expression that rejects the empty emotional bombast which is so particularly apt to put peoples against each other.
Reinforcing this truth, giving it strength and stability, is another from the record of history. Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, the president of the International Council of Scientific Unions, drew attention to it in a public lecture he gave during the Atoms for Peace conference. This is what he said.
I would emphasize that human expressions of precise conceptions on which science is based have come from no single nation or race or group. The body of knowledge and its application, that is the very basis of our civilization, has been derived from the works and thoughts of every element of the human species. We need only recall that the present system of numbers, the very basis of scientific mensuration and arithmetic, was learned from the Arabs, by the Arabs from the Hindus, who conceived the philosophical utility of the symbol zero. And with the improvements added by the Arabs, the system has replaced universally all earlier numerical representations. Thus, step by step, scientific knowledge and methods have originated from every conceivable human source. And so, scientists everywhere have come to recognize the first great truism underlying the growth of scientific thought, that original thought and methods in science know no boundaries of politics, race, religion, or political philosophy. that science flourishes best when all sources find equal opportunity to contribute.
So much for the vital philosophical and historical foundations. Add to them the urgent superstructure of the mid-20th century scene, with its almost incalculable potential for good and evil, and we can pass on to the consequences, to the beacons of wisdom, which are, in the words of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Doug Hammarskjöld, illustrations of the contributions which the scientific world can make to the broad political, economic, and social aims of the United Nations. The basic, all-important contribution is, of course, that the go-it-alone technique just doesn't work in science, any more than it does in any other human enterprise. But to leave it at that is to edit the material too drastically, to miss the full significance of the spirit and practice of international scientific cooperation. So, let's examine two fields in which the material is rich and the significance great: nuclear physics and geophysics, the steadily expanding fabric of cooperation in the development of atomic energy, and the already massive achievement of the International Geophysical Year. Dr. Paul Jolles is a scientist from Switzerland. He is now working in Vienna at the newest of the UN specialized agencies, the International Atomic Energy Agency. At the Atoms for Peace conference in Geneva, he read a paper from which we quote this passage.
"It is not the least important aspect of atomic energy that it has provided a strong impetus for joint action among the nations of the world. The economic and technical incentive for cooperation has been so strong that atomic energy has become a unifying force and has been used as an instrument to bring about political cooperation and even integration."
Examples? Many. And they take many forms: bilateral agreements between individual countries, regional research establishments, worldwide multilateral machinery. Two typical cases of bilateral cooperation.
Agreement on aid rendered by the Soviet Union to the Czechoslovak Republic, enacted in Moscow, April 23, 1955. The government of the Soviet Union will help the government of the Czechoslovak Republic to install an experimental nuclear reactor and a cyclotron by designing these installations.
Agreement between the governments of Canada and the government of India, signed in New Delhi, April 28, 1956, for the construction of a 40 thermal megawatt research reactor at the Indian Atomic Energy Center at Trump.
Turning to regional cooperation, there is one outstanding case which has proved its worth not only in the particular region itself, but throughout the world. At the Atoms for Peace conference, many tributes were paid to it. This one from a paper by the American physicist, Professor Isaac Rabi. We quote,
"An example of what can be accomplished in science by active collaboration of nations can be seen right here in Geneva. Under the stimulus of a resolution adopted by the General Assembly of UNESCO in 1950, a European Center for Nuclear Research was set up in Geneva. This is the famous CERN laboratory. This great and expanding international institution is the result of the collaboration of 12 European nations banded together to provide research facilities in high-energy physics. Owing to the great cost of some of these facilities, they're beyond the capacity of any but the largest and wealthiest countries. When the burden is shared, the problem is greatly reduced. Here in this laboratory, you will find scientists of many different nationalities, from many different regions of the world, working happily together, almost unconscious of differences of nationality. The great success of this laboratory is an inspiration to all of us and the embodiment of a hope that successful collaborative efforts can be expanded to other fields of science, indeed to other branches of human endeavor, so that we may find in this arid world of strife living oases where people work together as people, undistracted by tags of race or nationality."
At the worldwide level, where large numbers of nations are involved, the examples of cooperation are diverse and numerous. One of the most significant is the very fact of the existence of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has, as one of its prime objectives, the development of nuclear power in the underdeveloped regions of the world. Then there is the World Bank, which, from its multinational resources, is helping to finance the construction of atomic power stations in Italy and Cuba. The ease with which scientists can get together has also been demonstrated by the comprehensive study and report by the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, by the recent conference of experts to study the possibilities and techniques of detecting nuclear explosions, and, not least, by the two great Atoms for Peace conferences in Geneva.
As a reporter for UN Radio, I was fortunate in being able to attend both the 1955 conference and the one in September this year. It's difficult, without becoming rather embarrassingly over-enthusiastic, to give a true impression of the human quality and impact of these historic meetings. But the most striking thing was undoubtedly the almost tangible sense of freedom which enveloped both conferences, a sense of freedom generated by the personal contacts made by so many men from so many countries, and by the clear demonstration that secrecy and science don't mix. I remember particularly a paragraph in Professor Perrin's opening address to the second conference.
To enclose important fields of research and scientific work by preventing the men engaged in them from communicating freely with those studying the same problems in other countries is to lose all the benefit of the mutual understanding and fraternal feeling in the same task that comes with the normal relations between scientists. It is a breach of fundamental human freedoms and rights, freedom of expression and of information, the right, even the duty, to impart instruction, the right of all to learn and to know all that has been discovered of the mysteries of nature.
And I remember, too, a sentence from Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld's speech to the assembled delegates.
Your activities here conform exactly to the most fundamental of United Nations aims and purposes. Yours is work which can make peace even more vital, which holds forth increasing promise for man's progressive well-being.
And so to the second chosen field for this program. The poet Carl Sandburg has written,
"Everywhere the sun, moon, and stars, the climates and weathers, have meanings for people. Though meanings vary, we are alike in all countries and tribes in trying to read what sky, land, and sea say to us."
To read what sky, land, and sea say to us. The words of a poet for the scientific term geophysics. We are alike in trying. The poet's words for perhaps the greatest cooperative scientific enterprise in all history, the International Geophysical Year. Number of countries working together, 66. Number of scientists involved, roughly 10,000, though it's doubtful if anybody has bothered to take an exact census. The planning began in the spring of 1950, when a small group of them, meeting quite informally, decided that something must be done to clear up some of the many mysteries of nature surrounding us. Despite the fact that we've been occupants of this global home of ours for such a long time, we're still remarkably ignorant of many of its features. So, out of that small meeting in 1950 came the suggestion that the nations must get together to collect the sort of geophysical data so badly needed. The informal suggestion became the formal undertaking. The International Council of Scientific Unions set up a special committee to organize the year. Though an immense amount of detailed work had to be done, it was, in a fundamental sense, easy to do, because cooperation comes easily in the scientific world. And in the case of the IGY, there was an obvious and practical reason for it, as explained now by the Secretary-General of the Special Committee, Professor Marcel Nicolet of Belgium.
International collaboration during the IGY was a necessity because it is essential in geophysics to make simultaneous observation over the whole globe. The interrelation between the various fields of geophysics, probably closer than in any other branch of science. Closer cooperation has resulted from the discovery that all geophysicists speak the same language.
Now, 8 years after the original suggestion, the IGY is drawing to an end. Years, perhaps decades, of routine experiment and exploration have been compressed into 18 months by intensive, coordinated international action. Meteorology, oceanography, glaciology, seismology, geomagnetism, radiology. In all, some 14 major scientific disciplines have been involved. The Earth's core, its crust, and the cosmic space above have been the laboratories. It's too early yet to catalogue the results and the potential benefits which will emerge from them. But One thing is quite clear. The whole vast undertaking has been a triumphant success. It has inspired scientists everywhere. We recorded many enthusiastic comments, like this one by Dr. Sidney Chapman of the United Kingdom, president of the special IGY committee.
The enterprise is one which calls to mind our common human existence on this planet and shows the possibility of effective free collaboration between nations of different race and under different types of government.
And like this, by the deputy chairman of the IGY National Committee in the Soviet Union, Professor Balanche.
За всю мою работу в период международного геофизического года, начиная вот с...
In the whole of our work during the IGY, we have always, in meeting scientists from other countries, encountered the warmest understanding. Without their cooperation, our work in the Soviet Union would not have been as useful as it has in fact been.
And this from a French scientist, Professor Laclavier.
Friendly links have been established between the scientists of all the nations, and I consider myself that this is one of the most remarkable achievements of the International Geophysical Year.
And again this, from Dr. Juan Radera of Argentina.
En el reciente Congreso Internacional del Año Geofísico Internacional, realizado en Moscú,
The recent conference on the IGY in Moscow revealed to us for the first time all the success we may expect. It was very clear that many fields of geophysics and astrophysics would never have been clarified without this great common effort.
And finally this, from Professor Takeshi Nagata, Secretary of the Japanese National Committee for the IGY.
Japan is a country with a special interest in geophysics because in Japan life is so closely affected by natural phenomena. We are subject to typhoons, earthquakes, torrential rain, volcanic eruptions, and so on. So we are eager to cooperate in the IGY, and in particular it was a great pleasure for us to work with our neighboring countries of Asia towards the same objectives.
Though it's good to hear such words, spoken with the authority of experience, it's in the actual operations of the IGY, in the mechanics of cooperation, that we come to the heart of the matter. Take the meteorological program. Throughout the world, there are some 2,500 stations, each one making observations four times a day in accordance with an internationally agreed procedure. Over 40 of these stations, operated by 11 different countries, are on the ice-capped continent of Antarctica.
Hello, McMurdo Sound. Hello, McMurdo Sound. This is United Nations Radio in New York calling McMurdo Sound in Antarctica. Come in, McMurdo Sound. Over.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Bowman. You're coming in loud and clear by plane. Over.
Lieutenant George Bowman is a meteorologist, stationed at Weather Central in Antarctica. We called him by radio circuit and put this question to him.
Lieutenant Bowman, how is the meteorological work organized by the nations maintaining bases in Antarctica?
Well, there are over 60 nations participating in the World IGY program, but of these, only 11, the United States, Argentina, Australia, Chile, France, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, the Union of South Africa, the USSR, and the United Kingdom have bases in Antarctica. However, each of these nations have several stations, which gives us a network of over 40 bases in our meteorological network. It is interesting to note that these stations are so arranged over the continent that they complete the meridional lines of IGY stations in other parts of the world. So for the first time, we are able to prepare atmospheric cross-sections, not only for Antarctica, but from the South Pole to the North Pole. I would like to add that we have a small United Nations of our own down here. Little America serves as a weather central or collection center for all weather data gathered in Antarctica. And meteorologists for most of the nations that I just got through naming have gathered at Little America to work side by side in analyzing the data that comes in. It makes a very good arrangement all these gentlemen with their various experience from other parts of the world can get together and exchange ideas, and it makes a very good working arrangement at the Weather Center of Little America. Over.
To complete this part of the picture, we introduce Mr. D.A. Davies, Secretary General of the UN Specialized Agency, the World Meteorological Organization, in Geneva.
Data centers have been established for all the scientific disciplines covered by the IGY program, and a center for meteorology has been established in the Secretariat in Geneva. Now, the first thing to note about the work of the WMO center is that by the very nature of meteorology, the volume of the meteorological data being collected is very great. By the end of the IGY, something over 10 million reports will have been received from about 100 countries. And this information constitutes a very large percentage of the whole data being accumulated during the IGY. I believe it has been estimated that something like 70% of all the IGY data relate to meteorology.
As the flood effects pours in, WMO arranges for the information to be recorded on easily filed microcards. If it was published in the normal way, the flood would fill 900 volumes, each of over 500 pages. Obviously, a far too bulky and expensive operation. The small cards, however, eventually pass to national meteorological services, universities and technical institutes, where the final analysis is done. Altogether, an impressive illustration of active cooperation. Though not, in this particular case, a new one, as Mr. Davies pointed out to us.
It should perhaps be stressed that while in some scientific disciplines the idea of collaborating on an international scale to obtain coordinated data may be new and novel, in the field of meteorology, such a process has been going on for many years. And one of the normal features of international meteorology is the fact that many thousands of stations scattered throughout the world take routine observations and disseminate this information throughout the world by all modern telecommunication methods, according to internationally agreed schedules.
But what of the future? Officially, the IGY, as originally planned, comes to an end on December 31st this year. Even though it will take years to digest and interpret the huge mass of information that has been collected, it would seem a pity for such an obviously valuable operation to stop. And, in fact, it's not going to. Professor Marcel Nicolet of Belgium told us this when we spoke to him recently in Washington.
In view of the success of the IGY, an appropriate international framework has been established by the International Council of Scientific Union and is entrusted with the task of initiating and integrating collaborative research in geophysics on a planetary scale. An appropriate body called Special Committee for Cooperation in Geophysics has been organized and will enter into function when the Special Committee for the IGY terminates its work next year in June.
Other bodies, too, have been or are being formed to carry on work in particular branches of geophysics. There is
SCOR,
the Special Committee on Oceanographic Research, which is planning a thorough study of the Indian Ocean in 1961, using at least 16 ships from 11 countries. And there is
COSPAR,
the Committee on Space Research. On October the 3rd this year, a news item with a Washington dateline read,
"The General Assembly of the International Council of Scientific Unions today set up COSPAR. The group has the support of all the great powers. It will submit a plan for coordinating space research. It will take note of programs for space control now under discussion in the United Nations and elsewhere. It is hoped that a year from now, these plans will have been reconciled and that a permanent body can be formed to replace the committee."
End of item. A third new body is
SCAR,
the Special Committee on Antarctic Research, which will continue the cooperation and systematic exploration of the frozen continent after the IGY. As Dr. Berkner said in his lecture during the Atoms for Peace conference in September,
"New patterns for international collaboration are being constructed and tested. Some will enjoy success, and perhaps others will fail. But at least, men are rising to the challenge to provide opportunity to acquire benefits that international collaboration can provide. Now, men with vision can find the opportunity through the UN and the UNESCO and the ICSU that was denied to them only a few decades past.
The time has come to attempt a summary. What, on the basis of the evidence presented, and on a lot more which could be presented, what is the overall picture that emerges? On the one hand, we find scientists today, acting through their national academies and international unions, effectively organizing cooperative programs of work to deepen and broaden their knowledge and understanding, with all the implications for the future welfare of mankind that the process contains. On the other hand, the international political community, as represented in the United Nations and its specialized agencies, is recognizing with increasing clarity the truth of what Professor Perrin said in his presidential speech at the Atomic Conference.
For better or worse, man has linked his destiny to that of science. It is up to us to do everything we can to avert the worst and to exalt the best.
All this in a world deeply divided in so many ways, a world so often fearful of the future. The situation calls to mind a not very well-known episode in history. In 1778, in the middle of the American War of Independence, the great scientist and statesman, Benjamin Franklin, sent a letter to the commanders of all American ships then engaged in the war.
Gentlemen, a ship was fitted out from England before the commencement of this war to make discoveries in unknown seas under the conduct of that most celebrated navigator and discoverer, Captain Cook. This is an undertaking truly laudable in itself, because the increase of geographical knowledge facilitates the communication between distant nations and the exchange of useful products and manufactures, extends the arts, and science of other kinds is increased to the benefit of mankind in general. This, then, is to recommend to you that should the said ship fall into your hands, you would not consider her an enemy, nor suffer any plunder to be made of the effects contained in her, nor obstruct her immediate return to England.
A beacon of wisdom, undimmed by the passage of 180 years. A recognition that, even in times of conflict, there is a transcendent truth. Mankind as a whole cannot, must not be denied the fruit of knowledge, which is wisdom. And the consequence of wisdom is cohesion, not disintegration. This was the beacon in the minds of countless scientists of centuries gone by. It is the beacon which guides the minds of men of science today. You have been listening to Beacons of Wisdom, a program in recognition of the spirit and practice of international cooperation in science. This has been a production by the international staff of United Nations Radio.